Hello and welcome to a new English edition of my podcast Helium Talk, Das Kunstgespräch. My name is Jörg Heikaus and my guest today is Susanna Martin. Susanna is an incredible painter. Her work is super realistic but extremely playful at the same time. She works with the human body. Her protagonists are always naked and out in the countryside, surrounded by animals, air balloons, sweets, toys. Well, it is a pretty surrealist world that Susanna Martin shows us in her insanely detailed oil paintings. Okay, so I tried to capture this for you in one long sentence, but there's no better way to understand what I'm really talking about than to visit her website and take a look yourself. It is susannamartin.de, Susanna with an H at the end. You can also just check the show notes. I put that link in there. Susanna is originally from New York, but lives in Germany for many years. However, we still did this over the internet, and even though the new platform I've been trying out on this one seems to work nicely and is pretty promising, the sound could be better. But I hope you won't mind too much. It is a really good talk. Funny thing about this one is that Susanna is actually asking the first question here, so we talk a bit about how I met Jonathan Levine, who recently did an exhibition with her and recommended her to me. Speaking of Jonathan, the two of us will be recording a new episode of our ongoing conversation about the art world soon. It will be part 6 already. If you have any topics or questions for us, please write to me at hello@heliumtalk.com or connect at the website heliumtalk.com or on my @heliumcowboy Instagram. And don't miss out on future episodes and make me really happy at the same time by subscribing to this channel on your preferred podcast app. And I do love it when you leave a review on iTunes for Helium Talk. Okay, but now let's get started with my conversation with Susanna Martin.
Helium Talk. Helium
Talk. You and Jonathan go way back, right? That's what I heard, or what?
Yeah, we've met a long time ago, I think at one of these fairs, art fairs, when they were still fun. So like in 2006, seven. And I think 2007, we were the first time in New York. And I think that's when we hook up the first time, and then we went out for a few beers and, and you know, started what became a long lasting friendship between the two guys in this business.
And you were,
and now we're just talking about it.
Yeah, and you were with your gallery, right? You were there at the fair, and he was with his So you agree it's not fun anymore?
Well, actually, the story of Jonathan and me is a little bit different, because when I was on Scope Art Fair 2006, the first time, they asked me to be part of their how do you call it? The people that actually select and suggest galleries for the New York Fair, and I suggested Jonathan Levine, because I thought he was missing there. And then Jonathan afterwards told me that he applied a few times and didn't get in, you know, probably because he's too close. They wanted to have more international galleries at that time. And basically I don't want to say that he got in through my recommendation, but I think that, you know, it was probably helpful that, you know, I wanted his gallery in that show.
Sure.
And yes, it was a lot more fun then, because he actually, you know, so it wasn't so crowded everywhere. It wasn't so oversaturated.
Was it Miami? You're saying Scope Miami, or?
Yeah, Scope Miami was our first in the States. We did one or two in Germany before. In Cologne, I think we did our first fair. And the American market was super interesting for us at that time. So you actually made money when you went over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
it's worth it.
Since 2009, it's pretty difficult. I mean, I don't want to say there aren't galleries who still make money on these fairs, but
not the majority. Yeah.
And we're in a business where everybody tries to look, especially from the gallery angle, tries to look good, you know, so you'll never have a straight answer. I think that's one bit that Jonathan and I are trying to do in our
talks
that we have. Yeah. It's just, you know, sort of be blunt and say, this is how it is, you know, and Yeah, but I mean, you know, so we're here to talk about you.
I just wanted to hear a little bit of background between the two of you, how you met. And because Jonathan spent some time in Germany, right? He lived in Germany, but didn't he? Or
No, but he had a girlfriend in Germany, right. A German girlfriend, and he was here a couple of times.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and actually that's, I think that's the first time we really met was in Hamburg.
Okay.
You know, but coming, you know, I mean, some things are just not exactly present in my memory in regards to timings, you know, but I think we met first in Hamburg and then we met in New York.
Okay.
I think when we didn't even go to the fairs, I met him.
Yeah.
So that is then even before 2005.
Okay.
Anyway, so yeah, I mean, but you know, just sticking to that topic a little bit longer, how was your, was it your first online exhibition that you did with Jonathan then?
Yes. Yes. It was the first exhibition that we had together. Period. And then it was his first online exhibition, mm-hmm. Trying out a new sort of system, yeah. After moving his gallery. Mm-hmm. He hadn't really now. I think he's got the new place set up for some exhibition with a small exhibition space, but he first closed down the big one and opened up the next one, which actually also pretty big, but mostly offices and so he was going to try, I think he's still in process of trying to decide, you know, what's the best working, you know, the way to go about it. So he wanted to try just doing exclusively online exhibitions. And I was the first one.
The thing I ask myself about that one, I mean, I do believe in online. I do believe in that these things can work. But how does it feel when you're an artist and you have actually an opening and you're basically in Frankfurt and the opening is in New Jersey and you're just looking at the website or a chat?
I haven't had great experiences with these online exhibitions. I think that, and I'm starting to figure out why after I have this big solo show right now in Darmstadt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had an artist talk last week and a couple of people told me, you know, looking at my work online, they were really not sure what they were looking at. If they were looking at an oil painting or were they looking at, because these days you really can't necessarily tell. There's computer programs that make it look like a painting, mm-hmm. and it could be Photoshop. It's very difficult to tell. Mm-hmm. It could be anything, right? Mm-hmm. So the first question, the first reaction was, wow, this is old-fashioned oil painting. And so that's kind of, they were surprised by that. And so I think that's part of my problem with the online exhibition is you can't really tell what this thing looks like. And people don't know what they're looking at. And but these are, you know, complex oil paintings. And they're very time-consuming and... you know, it's not a print. I can't sell it for $100, you know, and so.
Yeah, I know, but it's of course. I mean, that's an issue that a lot of the artists actually face. I think you in particular, I have the same problem. I mean, I carve into wood and how do you transfer that onto the two-dimensional internet? You actually, with my works, you actually should, I mean, you should be able to touch them.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And
get right up close to them and smell them and you know, get a good sense of it. Yeah, a sculpture is particularly difficult.
It's like that curiosity that I had when I was young and went to museums. And I mean, when I was still at school and was interested, I was interested in comics but also in art. And at that time, Salvador Dali was, you know, kind of my hero in painting. And being able to go to Cologne to the museum where they had a few and just going really close to the canvas and actually see that, you know, so there were brush strokes
critical.
In there. And it's totally critical. Yeah, and that's kind of get lost. So you probably have to do a lot of detail imagery and stuff like that to get people...
I do, but it's still not the same. It's still not. And I think we get further away from it. I don't know, you know, how many people are actually going. Younger people are going to museums. I hope they are, but I don't know. So I think that I do prefer a physical show, and I hope that we get back more to that in the future. But I don't know. I know a lot of people like to buy online, but.
And a lot of people don't, you know, I mean, especially, I mean, a lot of people like to buy online their clothes and stuff like that,
yeah.
and everything that runs through Amazon. But I think it's very difficult. I mean, we're in a market where it's difficult to sell art in the first place and
now
online sometimes you know, so there's certain little projects that can work, you know, especially with drawings and stuff like that. But
sure,
it's still very hard. It's the biggest problem is to get actually the attention and get people to understand that they can purchase a few things. But I mean, that's very difficult. I mean, we're also, you know, so we're working with the Artsy platform, and sometimes we do online sales, but we sell those pieces to people who already usually own one of these works, or have been to the gallery or have seen it
in person. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, we're selling.
Know the artist's work intimately.
Yeah. They, you know, so that's probably very, very important. I think we've never sold a work by any artist that has not had other shows somewhere. And the people who purchased from us are usually from, the majority comes from the US actually.
Sure.
And they buy works that they've seen in the US and they can't get there at the moment, like Victor Castillo.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. If they know the artist's work, mm-hmm. I think that's fine and that works. But mm-hmm. you've got to have some physical shows.
Yeah.
Unless you're doing a type of work that is digital, you know, I mm-hmm. mean, then what's the difference really?
Yeah. Or print.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or print is okay too, if you don't mind. Even that, you know, it's like, you know, what does it really look like when you get on top of it? A print is not a print. I mean, a print isn't, they're huge varieties in quality. So,
sure, yeah.
You know, what are you actually buying? So there's pros and cons. It's great for people getting exposed to your work online. I think when you're talking about work that really is about craftsmanship in a way, that's difficult. It's really hard to get that message across online.
Yeah, totally. So, but I mean, you are thankfully you are exhibiting a lot. I think especially this year, you know, you have this exhibition at the TU in Darmstadt,
mm-hmm.
the museum. It's, mm-hmm. it's kind of a museum, right?
Yeah, the Kunstforum.
Kunstforum, yeah. Yeah, that looks like a big show.
It's
just
beautiful.
Has been extended.
It's beautiful. Just was extended till July 15th. And working with the curator, Julia Weichel, who is just fantastic. She's mm-hmm. fantastic. She was at not slipping my mind what I wanted to say, where she came from. But it's a beautiful show. And she worked there. The preparation for it was at least a half a year. And and you can see it. You know, she carefully selected the works, went through a great amount of trouble to get works from. We borrowed works that were sold already from collections and brought over pieces from New York. So she really went way above and beyond the call of duty to put together the show that she wanted. There were a few other things that she would have liked to have, but were, you know, sold. And one, a huge one, which is in Texas, is just, it's not coming back to Germany. So.
it's a bit expensive.
Not even for tons of money. You know, there is a budget, of course, but it's a beautiful show. And she's just been great with promoting it, inviting the press. We've had some press conferences and she does regular tours of the show, mm-hmm. explain the work to small groups and been very, very well visited, mm-hmm. which is why she extended it. I mean, so much work to put it together. It's kind of silly to close it down after 5 or 6 weeks. And mm-hmm. if you've got a steady stream of people coming in, why do that? So she decided to extend it. And I think that's really how you have to, in my opinion, it's optimal the way she's done it. And that's how you have to see the work with all the right lighting with, you know, it's just, you know, we hung the show about 2 weeks before it went up so that she had time. They had time to get the lighting just right. And really made some changes in the space. She took down all the curtains, and there were some blinds and things. They rearranged a wall or two, and they really went through great efforts to make it perfect. And
I think lightning is very critical to
lightning. Yeah. I mean, it's a great space because they have fantastic daylight. So during the day, it's perfect. Mm-hmm. And then they went through great lengths to get it just right for the artificial light for when the sun goes down. And really, as I said, it's just absolute it's just really optimal. And that's how you have to see the work, and people respond to it like that. And like you said, they can get right up on top of it and look at it and surprised to find out what it looks like in person as opposed to looking at it on the screen. Yeah, it's been great.
And you also, we also have another connection with another gallery I just saw on, I mean, that's a good thing about, again, on the online stuff. I saw your exhibition in Darmstadt. It's a lot happening there, and you can see
some images. If you go online to their website, you can see the Kunstform TU Darmstadt. You can see photographs of the exhibition and photographs of the opening.
You get a feeling for it.
Yeah. What were you saying?
Yeah, I was saying that the other gallery that I know the guys is the Lichtfeld from Switzerland.
Oh, you know them?
Yeah, I know them.
Freddie Hardorn and Mark.
Yeah, actually also guys that I met in the early days of these art fairs, 2007 or so. Yeah,
they're always there, right?
Yeah, and they're still there. Yeah, still going. And they're still going with their concept. They always had a different concept than other galleries with the art they're actually showing. So yeah, it's kind of nice. I think it's, I think you're in good hands there, you know?
Yeah, so. Mark is still very unusual, and he really steals the show when you're at an art fair. I mean, the video sculptures just suck people in. So they're having, you know, a steady run, and he's in a number of different art fairs. And what a wow. The work, though, I can't imagine it. Like, to transport all these video sculptures, and they're tough. They're tough guys. They really are. Yeah. Freddie was one of the first people one of the first galleries to discover my work, so to speak, and give me a shot in the trade fairs and an exhibition. He does some beautiful shows in Basel in his gallery, and he has some other off-site spaces that I was doing. Lichtfeld Biennial, he was doing a biennial exhibition. I don't know if he's doing that anymore. He's now involved with another off-site space. It's an old, what was it called? Sorry, everything's slipping my mind. When I have to remember something, like,
that's okay.
It'll come back to me.
Don't worry about it.
So he's involved in quite a lot in Basel, but mostly he's on the road with his trade fairs.
But when did you first show with him?
The first show, I think, was Lichtfeld Biennial, which was about 7 years ago, I think. Okay. And he brought four big paintings and brought them. That was, of course, that's part of the problem, though, is just getting between the EU and Switzerland is we've had a little bit of trouble there transporting paintings. It's a real pain. That was a beautiful show. And he held, and then he ended up taking one of those paintings to Miami, I think it was Scope Miami. And which, you know, the bottom line with it, my work does not do well at trade fairs. It just doesn't. It has never done well at trade fairs. And so between Mark's work, it's really hard for any painting to assert itself at all. I think it's great that he does a mixture, and I think that's important. But those video sculptures are so fascinating that it's really hard to get past them.
I didn't even want to have a booth next to him.
It's tough competition. It really is.
It's the entertainment factor that actually draws people into certain booths. And But I mean, you know, still, I mean, that's, I think it's still important to be present at some of these things. And if people, you know, sort of can at least see you, then it's, there will always be work that does well in certain places and doesn't do at all in others. You know, there are differences between markets as well. My sculptural work, for example, I have good clients here in Germany, and Jonathan had one really large and in my eyes, pretty difficult piece to sell, not from the content, but from the depth and everything and from the layers. And so they work pretty well, but like my Danish gallerist, he cannot he can't sell works that are not in a square or rectangle format and are flat on the walls, unless it's a real sculpture like a vase or something. But he usually, so he sells my flat work, you know.
He can only sell flat work, is what you're saying.
Well, he never sold a three-dimensional piece of it. And okay. And that's
his market that has to do with his clients, or
yeah, totally. I think every market is kind of different to the works, and I mean your works probably also pretty polarizing to people.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean you're realist. I mean you're working in the how do you call it, a realism? You know, mm-hmm. That's basically. Well, we started with difficulty online, whether it's a painting or, you know, sort of a photograph, but because you work photorealistic. Have you always worked photorealistic?
I wouldn't consider myself a photorealist, but it is realism for sure.
Yeah, it's realism.
I mean, it's a figurative realism.
Surrealism then. Yeah.
You know, other than my time when I was at art school, where I did experimenting with abstraction and all mm-hmm. kinds of things, and I do a lot of photography, I still do. Mm-hmm. And I did also video work, and I even did some sculpture in art school, and played around with some different styles, but I always came back to realism. So I eventually just accepted that I was a realist painter, and like it or not, that's where I am. And I had to come back to the figure also, despite mm-hmm. the fact that it's a really difficult subject as far as selling artwork is concerned. And it's probably counter avant-garde or contemporary, you know, it's questionable, but it's, you know, you got to do what you got to do. It's, you have to be true to yourself and where your interests lie. And so I wasn't really happy until I got back to the figure. Mm-hmm. And right or wrong, that's where I'm staying.
Yeah. You are from New York and you studied in New York, but then you also did like stage paintings. You know, like backgrounds for theater or productions?
Right. I went to New York University, studied mm-hmm. art. I have actually a Bachelor of Science degrees because I studied all kinds of things in addition to art, but I was a painting major mm-hmm. and studied with some great teachers, John Passeri, Sherry Levine, and Peter Campos was my video teacher. It was a great department, very small. Anyway, got out of school. I always had to work because I come from a poor family. Mm-hmm. I always had two jobs, probably from the time I was 10 years old, something like that. Started working for a set painting company while I was going to NYU part time, and then tried to get a grant to do a master's degree. Mm-hmm. At the end of my bachelor's, that which didn't work out immediately, and I was already in debt from undergraduate, as it is in the United States, because it's outrageously expensive. And I had a partial scholarship, but still, I don't know what it was back then. It was at least $20,000 a year plus living expenses, etc., which is probably compared to what it is now, nothing. But back then it was anyway. So the grant didn't come through right away, and I was quite frankly so exhausted that I just thought, okay, I'm just going to start working full time. Mm-hmm. And I started working for this set painting company full time, doing my own art on the side. And eventually the set painting took over. I just thought, okay, this is, you know, I also had jobs as a dental assistant, working in for an architecture firm. I did everything. I was working in the library. And I just decided at a certain point that it was better to be earning my money painting every day mm-hmm. and to continue to work on my skills and then to be working as a dental assistant and doing my own paintings on the weekends or something like that. I just really need to be painting every day. So,
you're still doing that? You're still painting every day?
Pretty much. If I'm not, I mean, this week I'm doing office work because I've been outside for so long because I was painting every day for the last mm-hmm. 9 months. But yeah, pretty much. I don't feel comfortable if I take a long break.
I understand.
Feel stable physically as a person. So I worked for that company for about 7 years, and then I decided to quit and go independent and just try, being a self-employed set painter and mural painter.
Yeah.
Actually, for a long time, I did more murals than set painting. And then I moved to Germany in 91 and started that business in Berlin, painting backdrops for film photography.
And what was the motivation to go there in that time? Because that was a very exciting, probably the most exciting time in my time of life. Because I moved to East Germany in 90, right when the wall came down, coming from Cologne. And I've spent a lot of time in Berlin as well around those years.
I was in New York. I was dating a German architecture student, a master's of architecture. He was from Frankfurt. And he just finished, got his master's degree, and right when the wall came down, and he said, he applied for some jobs in New York, but he had this nagging feeling that he should be in Berlin, because that's when things are going to start to happen. That's where things should start to happen, right? To rebuild Berlin, basically. And so he just decided he was going, and did I want to go with him? And I was absolutely right on board with that. I had tried actually much earlier to get a Fulbright scholarship. I really wanted to study in Cologne way back when Lichter was there.
Düsseldorf, yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's there. Richter and Hank.
It was a good time for the,
super interesting place to be. But I couldn't get the scholarship and I didn't have the money. So that dream went on the back burner. Yeah. So when Roland wanted to go to Berlin, I was ready to go. And just took my little... in the beginning, I went back and forth between Berlin and New York. I had clients in New York. I was doing wall painting projects, did a couple of big projects, and then took my money back to Berlin and just sort of lived on that and, studied German and tried to adjust to the culture. And, we also moved to East Berlin. So that was to Prenzlauer.
It's probably more affordable than New York at that time. Right?
Yeah, it was. I was basically like schlepping the cats every day and trying to keep the house warm and waiting online to make a telephone call or trying to survive. So, which was a great experience. I mean, coming from New York.
It's funny because I mean that's actually the same time that I was doing that in Halle,
so you know the experience.
Yeah, but I loved it. It changed my life in many ways. I mean, not only did I meet my wife back in Halle almost 30 years ago, 28 years ago, I think 29.
Yeah,
and it was a super exciting time, and I think it's I think when you're an artist, it was probably also very inspiring.
Absolutely. Yeah. And and then I started to think, there's film people in Berlin and there's probably some people who want, I don't know about the murals, that's kind of a high end thing. But set painting, that must be possible. And I started to sniff around, see what I could do. And indeed I found photographers and film people who wanted backdrops. And I started painting them. I first started in my living room, much to my boyfriend's chagrin, was painting huge backdrops on the floor, 4 meters by 6 meters, completely took over the living room. But it had this really old, messed up floor anyway, so it didn't really matter. But I did a small selection of backdrops there and about, skies, landscapes, textures, things like that. Put together a little brochure and started renting them out. And that kind of worked. I mean, it wasn't big money, but it started to work. And then he got completely fed up with Berlin because it wasn't moving as fast as he thought it would. It took him just the bureaucracy of it, I think, was so difficult to get anything built that it just wasn't fast enough for him. And he said, you know, let's go to Frankfurt. That's where they're building and there's money and, you know, mm-hmm. sick of it.
Yes, at that time, it's true, yeah.
Yeah. So I followed him to Frankfurt and he was right. I mean, it was just, you know, there were at that time, actually, Frankfurt was a pretty, still is for advertising, not at all a bad place to be. You'd either be in Frankfurt or Hamburg or Munich. Probably Hamburg is still kind of the advertising capital. No?
There's a lot of advertising and media companies here, but a lot of them have also moved to Berlin
in the last years
because that has changed with Berlin. In the beginning, I know Berlin was very slow and it was very hard. There was no money. It was the most exciting place to be in Germany, but there was no money. And many companies went there and then closed their shop again. And there was, you know, basically there was a good art fair, the Art Forum in Berlin. They had to close because they didn't have any clients.
Right.
And now the whole outward in Germany, the focus is in Berlin now, you know, so things have changed a lot. You know, we were considering to move to Berlin at some point as well, but at least wanted to take a look at it because, you know, sort of, when I moved to Hamburg from Cologne, I moved here for a job and then that job didn't exist anymore. And then, I was very fed up with that. It's a totally different story. I decided to stay in Hamburg after we've actually checked out Berlin and we drove around town and we looked at it and I just didn't want to live in Berlin. It was too hectic, too big, too, you know, people with, I mean, I like things a little bit more. That was in 2001.
Okay.
2001, yeah, around that time. Yeah. And we decided to stay in Hamburg and I decided to open my studio I was already painting then again and had exhibitions. And then I decided to stick in Hamburg because there was not as much hype, you know, sort of for me, it's a little bit laid back is something that I really enjoy.
And
then there was not as much pressure. I opened the gallery more or less by coincidence because I had this great place as a studio and I thought I can, you know, so I should do something about the fact that there's not really any good exhibition places,
for the people. Space and then
Yeah, you know, I mean, my studio became the gallery and then, you know, sort of, and these days I'm moving back a little bit. The gallery is becoming more and more my studio again.
Okay.
I thought it would be, you know, sort of better to build something like that up in Hamburg. And it, you know, turned out to be pretty good to stay here.
Yeah.
But, you know, at that time there was also no money in Berlin and now it's different. It's a totally different town. But I mean, I always say with Berlin, you always have to understand the fact that Germany never really had, I mean, West Germany, we didn't really have a capital that we were proud of. It was Bonn, you know, Cologne. That was basically the capital of West Germany. And every country of any kind of significance, or at least that feels significant, wants to have a capital like Paris or, you know, sort of, or at least cities like New York,
the metropolis
and London. And of course, you know, so now Berlin has become that, you know, but it took a long time to get there.
It took a long time. It did.
Yeah.
And then I don't know if, from what I hear, if the art world, there's a lot of shows, there's a lot of parties. Yeah. Is it actually function better than Cologne? I don't know. That's not.
I mean, Cologne is traditionally the gallery city in Germany, you know, so it was, at least, I mean, back then, you know, when I was still living there, with the Art Cologne still being the most prestigious art fair in Germany, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think this is still a lot of hype around Berlin. It's still a lot. Everything's the biggest, you know, sort of everything. But you also get overseen very easily, of course, in the city. I understand young people moving there and trying to make something there happen. But I know also a lot of artists who've moved to Berlin because they thought it's much better. But now it's getting too expensive and they don't get the exhibitions there either. And they're one in 3 million, basically.
Right. Just a little fish in a big pond. Yeah.
For example, in Hamburg, we have a pretty good local scene, and Hamburg is a big town too. But we still there's a good local scene. People know each other. Galleries work together. That's kind of enjoyable.
How would you describe it? I mean, I would describe the art market in Frankfurt. I mean, I think there's a good alternative scene here as well.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, but the art market itself, I would describe as being fairly conservative. How would you describe the
Hamburg?
Yeah.
Well, Hamburg, there's a lot of money in Hamburg that's not being spent on art. So yeah, it's we got a lot of rich and wealthy people in this town, but they are not necessarily art buyers or spreading it. You know, you see a lot of wealth on the street in terms of cars and houses and things like that.
What's the taste like? How would you describe that? I mean, Berlin's kind of freaky. That's the plus side to that.
I wouldn't describe Hamburg as freaky, but we got a couple of good, you know, so we got a good alternative scene with the Gange Viertel, for example, which is more or less an artist run place just around the corner from where the gallery is. We have a good street art and graffiti scene. Also, there's a lot of heritage in that regard. You know, a couple of the more important graffiti artists come from Hamburg, like Dime and others. You know, there's a good history of that. It's always been a good history because of the closeness to the hip hop. You know, hip hop has always been strong in Hamburg. Music is very important in Hamburg. So there's a good alternative scene. Market wise, I think it's pretty shit because people here don't like to spend money on art. We have good turnouts at exhibition. People like to come. We basically every gallery, you know, sort of is trying to look at the same people to purchase art. It, depending, of course, in which era you are. If you're more in a realistic paint, if you're more modernism, if you are urban art, there's all kind of different scenes of buyers as well. But, the best times with Helium Cowboy in Hamburg we had when we were on these international art fairs, and I basically at certain points I sold 60% of the work to the US and 40% here in Hamburg and Germany or Denmark or so.
At the art fair.
Yeah, at the art fairs and through our shows. I mean, when you go to, at that time, when you went to an art fair and you promoted and showed an artist, we did a lot of special projects with artists and solo booths. At that time when nobody else was doing that in a way. We did a lot of public interventions and installations with Boris Hoppig, for example. And then you have American clients that are interested to get a portfolio of an exhibition before you open in Hamburg. And then, you know, so we were pretty good experts in shipping works.
Right. to the US. Sure. Which is no small project. But that art fair doesn't exist anymore, or it just has changed?
No, the art fairs exist, but in 2008, when the Lehman Brothers burned all the money, and the financial crisis started, my American market more or less vanished overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because everybody was getting very conservative and was looking where to put the money. That's also when, you know, it was like I wouldn't really call it a bubble at that time, but there was a new kind of art that we presented that is now totally mainstream. It's younger artists. I wouldn't really call it urban art necessarily what we presented. We started out before that term actually was started to be used. But this has become a whole different industry and a whole different machine, it's also probably not necessarily good in terms of art sales, but there's a lot of oversaturation in that one. And and art lives a little bit from the exclusivity. And if you have five artists that do great stuff and that you can build up as a gallery from, for example, say, with a background in graffiti or urban art, that's enough for a gallery. And that's enough for five galleries, actually, because there's only so much art that people can look at. But if everything gets, you know, sort of so random. And today we have artists, especially in the urban art realm, that are they're basically copying other artists. Mm-hmm. They're copying each other's. And so there's not that exclusivity as it was before. It's there's a lot of the things that are, when you are a gallery and you take care of an artist, you actually cover a part of an artist that the artist does not have to cover. It's like all the catalogs, all the writings, all the, you know, sort of actually finding people who are interested in the work, you know, helping, supporting an artist and developing herself or himself more by keeping that way. Now every artist has to have his own Instagram, has to work on his own PR and marketing. And these things are changing, and I think now we are in a time where when you come to young art, young contemporary art, and young contemporary artists, They also have their own younger buyers that not necessarily buy from a gallery like Lichtfeld or Jonathan Levine or Helium Cowboy, because they have their own galleries. You know, so like if you're now 28 and you're making your first money at 25, between 25 and 30, you're making your first real money, you have a really good job. And the first time you make some money, you probably don't have kids, so you still have a little bit more money, you know, left in your pocket. You rather buy from a young, fresh gallery who, where the gallerist is also like 25 or 30 years old and has younger artists that then of course there's a different kind of market for these people as well, you know.
It's good to even buy from a gallery, right? But which is what I'm just noticing so much, that most people try to connect with me directly and I really have to work hard to get them to call the gallery. Oh, we saw your work here and there. It's like, okay, so what, you know, why don't you call the gallery where you saw it, or call you know, the exhibition space, whatever it was, you know. And that's, they really try with all their might to go to get around it. And I'm finding that to be very difficult. People have gotten used to getting direct contact to the artist, and they kind of expect it, and that's what they want. And then you try to steer them towards the gallery, and then they disappear into thin air. Like, they just, you know.
Yeah, they want to pay the overhead without that overhead. I mean, the market is changing anyway, and that's one of the things that Jonathan and I are discussing. That is also always a part. And it's funny that the two of us are starting to talk about this in a podcast that's about your art, which we will come back to that. Right now it's all about basically finding out how this market will function in the future, and things will be different.
Even how it's functioning right now, I find it hard to figure out, because there's still certainly there's a level that of collector who, sorry about that. I don't think I can turn that off. But,
I don't hear anything. It's okay.
Oh, good. Okay, then that was just me. There's a level of collector who still wants to deal with a gallery, right? But there's this huge, and that's the thing through the internet, is that there's a lot of just general public who now feels that art is more accessible because they can get to the artist and they can try to buy it online and they can buy it directly without the gallery. So they're all involved too. They don't really see the purpose of the gallery. I think there's a serious collector obviously does. So it's very, I find it very confusing at the moment, very confusing and very difficult.
I believe that serious collectors, they will always go through their galleries or their normal access points because they know of the value of a gallery to an artist. In what I said earlier, you know, I mean, just, you know, taking care of all the maintenance, organizational and promotional parts and aspects and build it. I think if you just want to buy a work from an artist because you're like, I think today people buy, you know, sort of, I mean, I don't think that there are many collectors these days, of the younger collectors or of the new collectors, that actually say, I collect this artist for the next 30 years, you know, because that was always, that's always part of, you collect not one piece from every artist that you like, but you collect certain artists. Some of my most important collectors, of course, they are some that do that. You know, that at some point, one of my collectors who has been buying from me for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, he said, okay, show me your backlog. Show me everything you still have, you know, sort of back there in the archives, because I want to buy older work from you. Yeah. You know, so that's that kind of collectors is very, very,
it's becoming rare. It's rare now, right? I mean, that's why it used to work, right? But that's now there. It's more eclectic, right? The collections are more, or just people who are buying just because they. I think part of my problem is that. I think I appeal to a very specific type of collector, and it's not, it's really not a mainstream type of person. I mean, somebody who buys nudes, right? Buys figurative work to begin with, but also somebody who's comfortable with a nude. My work is not erotic at all, but there are collectors who collect nudes and collect erotic art. And that's a specific type of collector.
I think your collectors have to be pretty progressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And cosmopolitan. And
Yeah.
So it's almost like, I'm difficult to fit into any specific movement or genre. So it's kind of like a, almost like a culty type of thing, you know? And so you have to find those specific collectors who are into that. It's sort of somewhat.
You know, I think, I mean, without having actually ever seen a work of your personally, and without having spoken to you before for this conversation, I think that a lot of people will approach your work and will look at it and say, it's mind blowing, but I cannot hang it in my office, in my home and stuff like that. Because I mean, the paintings, they are mind blowing. I mean, it's like, for me, it's always like a little bit of an explosion that you look at, you know? So there is, there's a whole universe in there, or at least a part of the universe. And you use the human body and of course also animals and nature in those works, and it's all very, you've all seen this, it's all very, you know, sort of when you know the human body, you know it's like, it's familiar, but it's not at all. So which is probably a part of surrealism as well, that's strong in your work. So I think that people, I mean, everyone I show your work to, they're all like, wow, that's amazing. I think you need a certain kind of clientele to actually, you know, who actually buy it. But you as an artist, you probably don't start out and say, who's going to buy this? You just say, I have to do this.
No, you can't. You really can't think like that. If I would think like that for a minute, I would never be doing the work I'm doing, because it's a rare bird that is not afraid to hang my work, you know. I mean, there's some of my work is has less, I don't know, full frontal nudity, let's say, than others. And those are relatively easy to sell if things are sort of, it's a more conservative piece, right? I know what I have to do if I really need to sell a piece, right? But I don't want to do that, obviously. But you can't be, my collector is not a person who's afraid to have something like that hang on their wall. They can't be worried about what the neighbor's thinking. It has to be a very independent thinker, somebody who's really, you know.
Yeah. But where do these elements in your work come from? What's the importance of the nude body for you in your work? If that's a good question, I don't know. That's a question at all.
Well, I see it in the context of the nude as an art form. In a long line of artists who have dedicated their work to the human form.
So it's also historically.
Yeah, which goes back 40,000 years, right? Mm-hmm. This is one of the oldest. It is in fact the oldest subject in art is the human body, right? So that's how I see myself. I don't. There's absolutely nothing new about what I'm doing. I'm taking very ancient art form and trying to contemporize it, which includes my, you know, the fact that I'm photographing my people and my landscapes and I'm putting all these elements together. So I'm incorporating my film and photography work, so to speak, comes into the painting. Mm-hmm. There is a very strong, photographic aesthetic to the work. It's clearly not romantic realism. And that's important to me to make, because I think the great nudes that we think of, you know, the great painted nudes that we think of, the last great movement was probably in, you know, the 19th century. You know, it's very clear that I want to make a break with that. And I specifically also just the fact that I'm a woman making this work. There's very few work out there, at least historically speaking, the human body painted by women. And I do think we have a slightly different perspective that needs to be explored. I think we need more of it. And, so it's just so clearly an area that needs to be researched for me, that I need to go there. I just think there's such a wide open space of exploring to do in that area that was fascinated to throw my hand in and get at it.
It's also, I mean, these days it's it becomes more and more a topic. I mean, you've probably been censored on Instagram as well for the depiction of nudes. You know, I think that's
Facebook. Facebook has really got my number, and I can't even tell you how many times I've been blocked. I don't even know anymore. But basically, you know, I'll stay on there for a month, and then something will happen. Although I'm at this point very careful to put black bars over any genitals or nipples or anything, somebody will go digging back in some old photograph somewhere from 10 years ago and report me, and then I get kicked out for another month. And so I'm in, I'm out, I'm out. I had a professional page you know, I have a private page and a professional page. The professional page got shut down completely because they wouldn't let me post anything because it's open to the public. So now I have a private page. And although it's on a privacy setting, I still get harassed. And I don't know what that means. I don't know if there might be some people, some individuals who are harassing me, who are reporting me, who are trying to knock me out. I have to say it started with, you know, serious problems around in the lead up to the 2016 election, where a lot of people were starting to experience problems. It was sort of cyber war going on the internet, and I did post some political things, my political opinions, and pretty early on, and because I was very strongly anti-Trump right from the start, and that's when I started to notice problems. Now, I don't know if there's a connection. I can't prove it because you don't get to find out who's reporting your work, which is a part that I find really that part I find very disturbing. Somebody actually can just knock you out and you don't get to find out who that is. They maintain their privacy while they're attacking you, which I think is really
Yeah, I know a few artists that actually sort of have to close their account and then restart an account again. And it's never really their political opinions that they express. It's usually just if they have a nipple in there that you can see, things like that. I mean, things that we're in this industry, at least in this society, at least in our Western society, are pretty used to, you know, sort of seeing as something very, very normal. And every TV show, how many nipples can you see on Netflix on an average day, even, you know, sort of, you know, without anything, any protection for your kids or anything like that. And how much gruesome stuff can you see these days? Right. And I think that's always, I mean, I got a couple of artists that I follow that do work that is in a way very beautiful, but also very disturbing, but it has something to do with violence and gore, but that's okay.
You know, and that's okay. Fine, you know? They don't have
it's also a big discussion.
It's a huge discussion. And I'm not sure, as I said, I'm not sure because I see other artists also who get away with more than I do. And so, which is why I think maybe I should just close down my account and start again, because maybe I've got some people who are for some reason watching me and sort of, you know, kind of out to get. And that's the sense I get, because it just seems like I've been very careful. I am very careful. And I still get harassed. So I don't know. Instagram has gone better. I don't know if I should even say that, because then somebody's going to start harassing me. Right in the beginning, they closed me down. They shut me down. I posted, I think, literally my first photograph of a painting, which I did not censor. They erased my account. I started a new account. And since then, it's been okay. I've been cautious at times and then not very cautious. And some things, they think they've removed a couple of things, which I think is a much more fair way to go about it. I mean, if they feel like, okay, this one crosses the line, we've removed it, but we're not erasing your account, which is what they did before. I don't know, knock on wood. I kind of live in fear, you know? I mean, not really. I mean, if it happens, it happens, but I never know. I always like, but if I go to Instagram, turn it on in the morning or something, it's like, let's see if I'm still there. Somehow I am. But
yeah.
And the only place I've never had a problem is Twitter. Twitter is kind of a free-for-all. You can pretty much do whatever you want.
Yeah, I think Twitter is replacing Tumblr in a little bit in the non-censored way. At least that's what I heard. I mean, I'm not using either of those particularly.
It's not very helpful as an artist. There aren't really serious collectors on Twitter. It doesn't help you much, but at least they don't harass you. So it's nice to have a platform where you can actually, you know.
Yeah, I know. Like, but I mean, the most important one platform right now these days, you know, at least for now, is probably Instagram. And and we've been looking at while we were talking at your Instagram feed online, and I saw all the little tiny bars that you put on there. And you even take care with color sometimes so that they match the painting.
Yeah, which I've done that. But you'll see there's also others where I didn't. So
I know.
It's like this. I get harassed by Facebook, and I get shut down there, and I think, oh, because basically Facebook and Instagram are the same company, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So then I think, okay, so they're out to get me. I better be more careful on Instagram. And then I'll put bars on things on Instagram. And then I'll do that for a while. And everyone complains. Why are you doing that? You know, you get attacked for that as well, right? So then you start to, okay, you slowly get a little bit more less cautious. And then you'll just post the painting the way it is. Mm-hmm. And
also people like to discuss and argue a lot on these social media channels.
Yeah.
I don't even know where they take the time from. I mean, it's, I don't know. It's also one thing that I'm rethinking a little bit these past months, and how this can actually be helpful. Because if it's not helpful to me as an artist in regards to my development as an artist, or to me as a gallery in regards to improving sales and getting, you know, sort of better and more quality recognition and being able to support. Time, right? Yeah, it's basically just stealing my time.
Right.
Yeah. And the thing with artists, like, I mean, one thing that artists should be also supported on these platforms, because artists generate such beautiful content. Mm-hmm. I mean, no influencer who does a travel blog, or okay, maybe a travel blog, they create beautiful images as well if they're good photographers. But I mean, all this fitness stuff, everything that's being promoted and where people make a lot of money, or stupid things and memes and trash that's being, you know, sort of honored and that actually makes money to YouTubers who are just talking, you know, so not everyone, but some of them, we're just talking bullshit. Or they're playing Xbox, you know, and have like 3 million followers and get money for that. But artists, photographers, we create beautiful content.
And very genuine content, right? Yeah. It's like very individual and very genuine.
And we're giving it for free.
And for free, exactly. Yeah. Well, I think that's a beautiful thing. And I enjoy it. I just, you have to keep the whole thing in perspective, and you have to keep it in its place, and it shouldn't be an obsession, but something that, you know, you enjoy. And I have those feelings sometimes too. On the other hand, I've got some great followers, and they're so supportive, and they sometimes they have very insightful things to say. And a lot of people just say things like, thank you for posting this work, I wish I could afford to buy it, but I can't. And so I'm thankful that you post it and let us look at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's great. That's what, you know, that's also a very valuable activity. I mean, if you're actually exposing somebody to, or helping someone to think about human issues, which they otherwise may have thought they were alone on the planet, thinking about these things, you make some of that connection. I think that's very valuable on a human level. So
I agree.
You know, I don't keep it in perspective. You know, don't let it consume too much of your time. Don't be too obsessed about if somebody likes a piece or not. It's very often the case that the pieces that I think are, where something important happened in that piece might not really react, with the general public. And on the other hand, some things which I think are sort of like, that's just kind of another one. I don't know if it's a pivotal piece. gets a big reaction. And that's surprising. What is it about it that people are reacting to? And so that interaction is obviously, that feedback is important. It's sometimes very surprising. And then I have to stop and think, what is it? What is the nerve that I'm hitting there? Or why did I not hit a nerve in the thought things where I felt, at least for myself, I hit a nerve, and contemplate what that's about and what's actually going on in the work. And I think that, the work is about who's perceiving it, right? And then their experiences. So you're going to tap into things that you have no idea about, that you're completely unintentional. So, and that's very important feedback. What's going on in other people's minds is also a clue about where I also need to go. I mean, that's how you find out what the actual content of your work is. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's true. That's
important information.
Yeah, I think if you can reach that, if you can make your online exhibit, so to say, on social media, and turn that into an exhibition platform where you get the feedback from people, I think then that's probably the first big achievement that you can make with it. So that's why we always say artists, have a good website. That's important. I think your website is awesome. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's, you find everything you kind of want to know. Sometimes that's people forget that basically I always compare it. Your website is your house, that you own this one, and the other platforms is just rented. They can go away anytime. They can cancel your account. They can, go out of business.
Right.
Or people find the next hip thing to do online.
Right.
And if you already managed to create that attention, and not just attention, I don't actually necessarily speak in numbers. I think if you have followers, which is already a weird word, but if you have people that actually interact with you in terms of that they like it and that they, I sometimes have also, not necessarily the interaction takes place on Instagram or on Facebook, but then I have an exhibition opening and I'll talk to people who I know personally, they've never commented or liked on these pieces because that's not what they do.
Right.
But then they say, oh, I saw this and, sort of your development here and it's very exciting. Mm-hmm. So if you use this as the basic foundation for your social media activities, then you have a good result and then it's already successful.
Right.
If you have 500 or 50,000 followers.
Well, it's also a way to reach people who are on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And you're getting a very different experience, for instance, at the at my solo show in mm-hmm. Darmstadt. I mean, you're talking about a range of people in the Rhein-Main-Gebiet. It's not that mm-hmm. huge, but and who's going to, or even how many people from Frankfurt are going to take the trip out to Darmstadt? It's not that far, but a significant amount of people did. And a lot of them are not people who have any connection with social media. They just go to shows. They look at real art. They're art lovers. They're true art lovers. And, what do they do in their free time? They go to shows. They look at stuff and they have very strong reactions and they want to talk about it and they want to interact about it. I mean, that's pretty cool. It's a good thing to do. So it's, Chad, you've got to take that joy as part of the, and put some weight on that success, because the monetary part of it is always going to be frustrating. It is.
Yeah.
The more time you spend working on that end of it, the business side, it's just kind of depressing. You think, well, this is because from a numbers perspective, this is a ridiculous thing to do with your time, to make these paintings. It just doesn't make any sense at all. But it's easy to lose sight of that's what it's about. That's not what it's about at all. It's about, making a human connection and talking about human issues and having an exchange there, and also trying to open up. It's a fight for freedom, basically, on many different levels. That's what my work is all about. Breaking down, intolerance.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I agree. It's It's if you're an artist, it cannot be about the money.
Yeah. We all have to survive, right? So you have to find a way to survive. That's sort of an evil that we all have to deal with in one form or another. And but try not to take that too seriously, because it can just get
can drag you down.
It can drag you down, and you know, I know that tomorrow I could do a different type of work. If I would just put a little bit of loincloth on my paintings, they'd probably triple the sales overnight, right? But like, I'm not going to do that. That's not what my concept is. I have to follow my train of thought. I have to follow, you know, these ideas that I have that need to get out there. And there's a reason why you're not seeing it elsewhere, and why other people aren't doing it, because it doesn't work in the marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. There's so many reasons not to do it, but there are also a number of good reasons to do it. Maybe we can actually break down some of these prejudices and intolerances and make more space for, you know, particularly, you know.
I hope so too.
A woman's perspective also, I think, is also, I don't know if it's...
Yeah, that's, you know, I mean, that's also one aspect that we didn't really get into today on this episode. Yeah, it's a huge topic, yeah. Maybe we reconnect in, I don't know, in a year's time and, you know, so recheck or, you know, a couple of months or whatever it's time. And maybe we do a German one as well, because I do it German and English, and there are some German people that do not listen to the English podcast.
Absolutely. Well.
But I think for today, I think we've covered a lot of things. I'm very happy this worked out. So far, the connection is pretty stable.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my biggest worry. Like making appointments for the podcast, and does the technology, you know, sort of work?
Well,
I mean, in the studio here, it's always beautiful. You know, when I have guests here, so whenever you're in town in Hamburg, make sure you come by. You know, and we
have a little while, but I'd like to get back. It's a beautiful, beautiful city.
It is. Yeah.
Great exhibitions. I always want to go to the Deichtor, and that's always something I wish I could see there. And
the current exhibition is great. Yeah.
If you were around the corner, I'd be there much more. But it's kind of a schlep from Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I just work too. I mean, I'm painting. My paintings are really time consuming, and I think I'm jealous of people who have a technique that, you know, they can, you know, do a painting in a day, and then they have the rest of the week to go look at shows or whatever. It's like if I don't paint around the clock, I don't get anything done. I mean, I'm doing maximum 7 to 9 paintings a year maximum, and that's working really fast.
Yeah. I mean, they're huge and they're very detailed, and
and it's very time consuming, but I'm starting to accept that. I'm just accepting this is what it is. I'm not going to do that many paintings a year, and I have to make more time to come to Hamburg and to Berlin and things like that, and really because I feel that that's a loss.
Yeah, you should. But you should also continue to paint, you know. So
I know.
I don't know. I don't know what to recommend you. I mean, you have to, you know. So I have to. All right. So Susanna, I'm glad we did this. Thank you very much for joining this podcast today.
For inviting me.
Yeah.
And let's have another one at some point where we can talk. I have a feeling that, particularly with you know going on in the USA right now and all this attack on women's rights and things, that this may be become a bigger issue than has been in the past about, you know,
totally.
The body and controlling the body. So we might need to come back to that at some point.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Helium Talk.